Look, I think it highlights some very important aspects of what we're proposing to do. I mean, when the Irish people voted for the Lisbon Treaty, they voted to have an opt-out on justice and home affairs issues and also the common asylum area. So Ireland has, by and large, opted out along with Great Britain when it was in the European Union and Denmark. It is now proposed to opt in, to essentially get rid of that opt-out, because once we opt into certain areas, then we can't opt back out again. And I think that's quite important. The other thing is, everybody refers to this as the pact, as if it's one document. It's not. It's 10 different laws which were voted on individually by the European Parliament. And we are going to adopt, or it's proposed that we will adopt 7. However, my understanding is that a political decision has been made that we will not vote on them individually, that we will vote on them all collectively, because the government wants to create a situation whereby you sort of lump it or like it, take it all or take none.
Which you referred to as profoundly undemocratic when you were questioning Minister McEntee at the Oireachtas Justice Committee.
No, it was when I was questioning the Taoiseach Simon Harris on the floor of the Dáil that I raised that particular point. But undoubtedly, some of these measures are beneficial. Undoubtedly, some of these measures don't really involve any ceding of sovereignty, because we've already opted in, for example, to a procedures directive. There's a revision of that procedures directive is one of the laws. We opted into a Eurodac measure. There's a revision of that, which is one of them. So opting into the revision makes eminent sense. I mean, we've already opted in. But there are other measures which I would be concerned about. But the most important thing is that the Dáil, which is the representatives of the people, get to debate this fully, and I've no doubt there will be a debate on it, but get to vote on these measures individually, because I think most, if not all, parties and groupings in the Dáil would support some measures, but it's this idea that you have to take all or take nothing, which is, there's no legal basis whatsoever for it. I questioned Department of Justice officials on this. There was a briefing organised, and they accepted that there was no legal reason whatsoever that we couldn't vote on them individually, but that a political decision had been made to lump them all together.
Michael, would you have any concern that if we were to opt out, if Ireland were to, for want of a better phrase, go it alone, that it could actually potentially lead to more problems? We've seen the UK sort of go down this route before, trying to take back control of their own borders, and they've ended up with more migration than ever because other EU countries just have no interest in helping them out. Could we potentially be in that position if we opt out?
But I don't think that, I mean, if you listen to what I said, I'm not suggesting that we opt out of all of the measures. I don't think anybody is suggesting that we opt out all of the measures. It's a matter of taking the measures which are beneficial to us, but not taking the measures which aren't beneficial to us, because these are separate laws that were voted on separately, and the government itself has already made a determination that we're not, that there are 3 of the 10 that we're not going to opt into. So then to say that it's all or nothing when the government itself is saying that we're not going to opt into all of them, it simply makes no sense. And it's a sort of a bit of a it's a political charade to say that we have to opt into all of them. In fact, we're now only opting into 7 or none. Nobody's suggesting that we not opt into some of them. I think it would be reckless not to opt into some of them. But it's to consider this carefully, to opt into the measures which suit us, because we're an island off an island off the mainland of Europe. That which is beneficial to the rest of Europe may not be beneficial to us because of our geographical position. And it was on that basis that Irish negotiators, when the Lisbon Treaty was being negotiated, secured that opt-out. They secured that opt-out for very good reason, I believe, and those reasons are as valid now as they were then. But undoubtedly, some of these measures are beneficial. Some of these measures I would support. Others I would have a lot of more concerns about.
OK, so the people should have a say. And would it be helpful, should the government publish the AG, the Attorney General's advice on the pact, Michael?
I think it's always beneficial when governments rely on the Attorney General's advice. They say the Attorney General's advice is this, that and the other, and then don't publish it. It is always beneficial. If you're going to rely on something, if you're going to say, well, we have this document which is guiding our views and it's informing our policy decisions, then I think you have to publish that. There is no reason whatsoever not to publish advice. It is privileged, but it is privileged to the government. If I, as a lawyer, give advice to you or to anybody else, I can't release that. The Attorney General can't release it, but the recipient of the advice, the person who receives the advice, is always free to publish it. And it's in circumstances where the government is relying on that and saying that they're relying on it and putting that forward as the reason that they're doing something, then I think in the interest of transparency, in the interest of open democracy, then I think that should be published.
Do you think even if the interests of transparency aren't foremost in their mind, they may look at the way the Attorney General's advice on the two referendums in March came out in the aftermath or in or around it and caused a bit of a kerfuffle, and they may just want to publish his advice just to avoid any of that kind of controversy?
Well, I would hope they would, because I think that was very damaging to government. It was very damaging to the institution of government, which goes beyond particular parties, because ministers were telling us that their advice was to a certain effect when afterwards, and it was published, we found that her advice was exactly the opposite. That's very, very damaging. People, that erodes people's trust in what the government is saying.
You questioned Helen McEntee in the before when she appeared before the Oireachtas Justice Committee last week, and clips of this have gained a lot of traction on social media and in media and beyond. There's been a lot of commentary on it. Her much criticised performance and struggling to respond to your questions. It's subsequently brought undue negative coverage on both her performance as Justice Minister and indeed the government's handling of immigration. Is the government failing when it comes to immigration policy? And was Minister McEntee's performance on that occasion a bit of a microcosm of how the government are or aren't more pertinently dealing with the issue?
I think the failing is less government policy than the implementation of policy. I mean, the government keeps saying we have a rules-based system, but everybody knows that the rules are not being applied. It appears that the Department of Justice is unable to apply its own system, is unable to apply its own rules. And of course, Helen McEntee, for the time being, is the Minister for Justice. There have been Ministers for Justice before her, there will be Ministers for Justice after. But whoever leads up a government department is responsible for the successes of a department and is responsible for its failures and has to take command of their department. Now, I'll give you an example. If there's a new Garda station being opened anywhere in the country, you'll see the Minister for Justice of the day. It's currently Helen McEntee. As I say, it's the same with others. They'll be up there, there'll be a great photo op, there'll be interviews in the media. If you ask about the closure of a Garda station, you'll be told that's an operational matter for an Garda Síochán. It's nothing to do with the Minister for Justice. You simply cannot have it both ways. It is for the Minister for Justice to lead her department. It's for the Minister for Justice to provide that leadership and to ensure that it's adequately resourced. Now, I'm not entirely clear what... It's very, very clear that there are big problems in the Department of Justice. I'm not entirely clear why those problems exist. I think it's a lack of resourcing, but it is up... That's a collective government decision. It's up to the minister to argue for the resources and make sure, no more than in health, and make sure that those resources are properly spent to bring about improvement rather than spending money for the sake of it. But right now, it does appear to me that the government, that the Department of Justice is unable to apply its own system.
And what did you make of Tánaiste Micheál Martin coming out after Helen McEntee's claim that 80% of asylum seekers are arriving here across the border from the north? His claim that he said this wasn't based in fact. It didn't seem to be a good look to have him questioning his cabinet colleague, especially after her appearance at the Oireachtas Justice Committee, where she faced questioning from yourself.
Well, it undoubtedly further undermined confidence in the Minister for Justice. I mean, when her own cabinet colleagues, when a former Taoiseach and the Tánaiste, the deputy Taoiseach effectively, says that there's no factual basis for her claims, it is very damaging. And I think it also undermines confidence among ordinary people that the government have any handle on what's actually happening with our with immigration in this state. Just to be very clear, though, we do need immigration. We do need people coming to work in this country. People come and perform vital roles across this state. We need that, but there has to be an organised system in place. The state has to be in charge.
Speaking of the Tánaiste, he has told Chris Heaton-Harris, the Northern Ireland Secretary, that Gardaí won't be sent to police the border. It had been thought they would do. Would this not have gone, Michael, against what we fought for during the exhaustive Brexit negotiations, where we were looking to retain an open border between ourselves and the North, which was a successful endeavour? And could there have been difficulties anyway with trying to police a 310-mile-long border?
Well, I mean, I don't think it was proposed to sort of set up border checkpoints or anything like that. I mean, it is for this state to police every acre of this state. So once people are inside the border of this country, it is perfectly legitimate for the Irish state to seek to police that, to set up spot checks. Now, it's they need to do that without relying on racial profiling or anything like that. But it's there's nothing wrong with policing immigration in this state. I suppose the manner in which it was announced again seemed to be knee-jerk, and there's an element of government by press release. I mean, if I just take another example. The Minister for Health came down and announced there were going to be 20 beds and that they were going to be in Caracalla. He told that to Clare FM journalists. Yet when Caracalla were questioned, they knew nothing about it. So, I mean, this government is now, it seems to me, governing by press release rather than by carefully crafted policy decisions. And that's very damaging. So you have one person saying something, another person contradicting them, and nobody apparently in charge.
Do you feel the optics of the way that was announced did not look good and was also grist to the mill of the UK government and Brexiteers who almost relished it? Certainly there was a kind of a smirk in Rishi Sunak's face in the House of Commons yesterday when he spoke about hoping that there wouldn't be the Irish wouldn't be policing the border close by. There was a kind of karma has come back to bite you kind of vibe from them.
Yeah, look, it's undoubtedly played into the domestic agenda of the Tory government in the United Kingdom. But, I mean, this 80% figure was quite a grenade that was thrown into the committee that nobody anticipated. Clearly, her cabinet colleagues didn't anticipate it because Micheál Martin contradicted it. It was, I think, to just throw out something like that without informing other state agencies, informing other departments, and looking into the consequences of it. Was very damaging. It clearly, as I say, the Tory government in the UK have seized upon this with great relish and decided that they're not taking anybody back and they're going to use this as a bargaining chip with France.
And Chris Heaton-Harris reiterated what Rishi Sunak had said, that the UK won't be taking back these asylum seekers across the border from the north until the EU do something about France taking back the asylum seekers who go from Calais to Dover. But we've seen the Cabinet approve Minister McEntee's proposals to quickly draft that legislation so the UK can again be designated as a safe country to return people seeking asylum, Michael. But it's falling on deaf ears across the Irish Sea. Is this actually going to be enforceable? Who is in the right here?
I mean, well, of course it's not enforceable. I mean, there is an issue over whether or not an agreement was made with the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom says no. Ireland says yes. Again, there have been calls to publish the documentation around that. It hasn't been published. I mean, if an agreement was made, then I think it's entirely legitimate that the Irish government should expect the UK government to abide by its undertakings. I mean, that's how life proceeds. People abide by their undertakings. If people make an agreement, they abide by it. And it's particularly important, of course, between governments. But it goes back to the central question, was there an agreement? The UK government say there wasn't. So I think this is something else that does need to be published.
I wonder what your take would be on the view from Brussels on this, on A, how Britain has gone about this, and also B, how we have reacted to it.
Maybe in a couple of months' time, I may be better placed to tell you what the view from Brussels is. But at the moment, I don't know. It's certainly, even from Scariff, much less Brussels, it appears very clumsy.
Okay, we know 200 asylum seekers were moved from Mount Street in Dublin yesterday from outside the International Protection Office. Most were taken to either City West or Crooklyn, where there's tented accommodation. And Simon Harris has said that makeshift shanty towns aren't going to be allowed to develop outside that office in the future. But I mean, given the lack of accommodation, Michael, how likely is it that not just outside the International Protection Office, but elsewhere in the capital, and maybe even beyond Dublin, how likely is it that these so-called tent cities or shanty towns are going to pop up again, given our issues with accommodation?
Well, it's unfortunately likely for two reasons. One, I mean, we have tent cities and proliferation of tents right across the state. I mean, when I went down to the Clare match in Cork last week, we parked up beside a tent where, unfortunately, which unfortunately was somebody's home. I mean, I don't know who was in that tent. I didn't in any way feel it was appropriate to try to find out or interrogate or anything like that. But I mean, that's the first thing. I mean, there is a shortage of accommodation in the country. The second thing is, We have quite a lot of accommodation for persons seeking asylum. There are over 26,000 in accommodation now, but it doesn't matter how much accommodation we provide, if we have more and more and more people going into a system and where that system is choked up and decisions are not being made and people are not being processed and coming out the other end, well then no matter how much accommodation you provide, it is going to be filled. Again, this goes back to the problem in the Department of Justice that they're not making decisions. I asked Helen McEntee how many people were awaiting. If you apply for asylum at first instance, you have a right of appeal. If your right of if your appeal is unsuccessful, you can then write to the minister. You have a very short period of time to do so, to say why you should be allowed to remain in the state. You know, it may be that you're working, you're performing a particular role, you've built up particular family relationships, etc. It's envisaged in the legislation that that decision would be made very quickly. There are people waiting years for that decision. Helen McEntee was unable to tell me how many people were waiting for a decision, how long they were waiting for a decision. To this day, they're unable to say. They say that they don't have the information on whether the numbers are getting bigger or smaller. I don't believe that. But it is, people have to be processed. There has to be a system and it has to be implemented. Decisions have to be made so that people are not stuck in a system. People are not stuck in direct provision. They're either, a determination is made that they can stay in the state, integrate in Irish society in exactly the same way as you and I do, Alan, or that they cannot stay here and they have to go. That's a very difficult decision to make, I accept, but it has to be made as more and more and more people seek to come to Ireland and stay here. And if those decisions aren't being made, we're building up a bigger and bigger and bigger logjam, and all of those people have to be accommodated. So I don't understand why. I mean, we're spending billions, we're making millionaires of accommodation providers across the state. They tend to be almost all very large businessmen. They're doing incredibly well out of this, but we're not putting anything like the same resources into decision making, and that is a fatal flaw of government, of how the government have treated this issue.
We started out speaking about the stall motion on the migration pact. Just before I let you go, setting aside who is and isn't in favour of having a referendum or national debate, would you say the chances of a referendum are extremely remote?
Well, they are, and I mean, constitutionally, there is no need for a referendum, because when we, as I say, when the Irish people by referendum voted for the Lisbon Treaty, they voted to have an opt-out, but they gave the Dáil the right to opt in to individual measures. The problem is that this government is saying we're not going to have a vote in the individual measures, it's take them all or take none, because they want to be able to criticise the opposition and say, well, you're against this and you're against that and you're against the other, and these are essential. Now, I agree that there are parts of there are some of the seven laws that the government want to opt into. Some of them are beneficial to this state, I've no doubt about that, but some of them aren't. And it's that, it's the government, because they've already committed at a European level to implementing this. They've put the cart before the horse. Instead of having a proper debate in the Dáil and then going to Europe with the result of that, they've already said that they're going to opt in, subject to Dáil approval. But they know they have the numbers. They'll whip all of the Fianna Fáil backbenchers, all of the Fine Gael backbenchers, and all of the Green backbenchers, and then they'll do a deal with one of the three or four independents that routinely support the government. I don't think that's a proper way to make a decision as fundamental to Irish sovereignty as that, because control of our borders is part of the sovereign powers of any state. There's a whole load of case law on that. But to go back to your question, it's not unconstitutional for the Dáil to vote on this. A referendum is not required, but what is required, in my view, is a proper vote, and not just take them all or leave them all, a proper vote looking at the merits of each piece, each of the seven pieces of legislation individually, taking the ones that benefit Ireland and not taking the ones that don't benefit Ireland, because we have a unique geographical position in Europe.